This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so welcome to the deep dive. Imagine you just wired a pretty significant chunk of your life savings to buy, I don't know, 10,000 shares of a really highly speculative company.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. You click buy, the money vanishes from your available cash balance. But you haven't actually received a receipt yet.
Right.
So at what exact second does the brokerage firm legally have to prove to you that the trade actually happened? Today, we are cracking open the heavily regulated machinery of financial operations.
Yeah, we are.
We're looking at function one of the Series 99 exam. So account statements and confirmations.
It is the absolute core of the test. I mean, if you're studying for the Series 99, you probably already know this section makes up 70% of the exam. Yeah, we are talking 35 scored items. You honestly cannot pass without mastering the specific plumbing of the financial system.
And look, I know what you might be thinking listening to this. The regulatory world of financial ops, you know, paperwork delivery deadlines, disclosure rules.
It just sounds totally dry.
It sounds so dry. It sounds like reading a dictionary of compliance terms.
Yeah.
But we are not going to do that today.
Yeah.
We're going to track the actual life cycle of a single invested dollar.
I love that.
Right. We're going to look at the real world mechanisms behind these rules so you understand why they actually exist. Because if you just try to brute force memorize a list of deadlines, the exam writers will absolutely bait you into picking the wrong answer.
They will. That is the perfect approach, because in financial operations, you'll find that similar looking documents often serve completely different regulatory purposes.
Hmm.
And knowing why a document exists, like understanding its actual mechanical function in the market, that is the skeleton key to passing this section.
Exactly. And to help us visualize this, we're going to rely on a cast of characters today.
Okay.
First, we have Careless Carl. So Carl is an enthusiastic but highly disorganized retail investor who just loves buying the most bizarre, illiquid assets imaginable.
Oh, we all know a Careless Carl.
We really do. We also have Broker Betty. Betty is Carl's perpetually exasperated but strictly legally compliant broker at the introducing firm.
Poor Betty.
Seriously. And finally, we have firm Fiona. So Fiona is the executive at the carrying and clearing firm.
Okay.
She's the one managing the giant vaults, moving the actual money, and just doing the heavy lifting in the background.
I really like this setup because on the exam, you have to know exactly who is responsible for what action and when that action must occur.
Right.
So having Betty at the introducing firm and Fiona at the clearing firm, that will be incredibly useful for mapping out the liability.
For sure. So let's start at the very beginning of Carl's chaotic financial journey.
Yeah.
Before we can look at his overall account health, we have to look at an individual action.
Right. The trade.
Right. Let's say it's Tuesday morning. Carl decides he urgently needs to buy 10,000 shares of the Iguana Sweater Company.
The what?
The Iguana Sweater Company.
Yes.
A penny stock for a company that makes tiny cable knit sweaters for reptiles.
Wow. Okay. Careless Carl strikes again.
Exactly. So he calls up Broker Betty, places the order, and the trade is executed.
Yeah.
Carl needs a receipt.
Mm-hmm.
In the operations world, that receipt is the trade confirmation.
Right. A confirmation is basically the customer's written record of what the firm did and in what capacity they did it. It's the absolute proof of the transaction.
Right.
And the most heavily tested concept surrounding this document is the timing. Like, when must that confirmation be given or sent to Carl?
Wait, let me make sure I'm visualizing this timeline right. And actually, let me ask the listener a direct question. So think about this for a second.
Okay.
Carl shakes hands on this trade with Betty on Tuesday. The trade is executed. But the money and the shares don't actually swap hands. Like, the transaction isn't completed until Thursday.
Okay, settlement.
So does Betty have to send that confirmation on Tuesday, the day they agreed to the trade?
I'll give everyone a beat to think about that.
Yeah, think about it.
No, she does not.
Ah.
And that distinction is so critical. The regulatory rule states that written notification must be sent at or before completion of the transaction.
Completion.
Completion is the reference point, not the trade date.
So if you are listening to this on a walk or at the gym or taking notes, circle this in your brain, because this is exactly how the test writers bait you into a wrong answer.
Oh, absolutely.
Any multiple choice option that says a fixed number of days after the trade date or within 24 hours of execution, That is a trap.
It's one of the most common pitfalls I see, because people confuse trade execution with transaction completion.
They sound like the same thing.
They do, but execution is just the handshake. It's Betty and another broker agreeing to the terms over the network.
Right.
But completion, which is often referred to as settlement, is when the actual mechanics of the trade finish.
So that's when Fiona comes in?
Exactly. It's when Fiona's clearing firm actually moves the cash out of Carl's account and takes delivery of those Iguana sweater shares.
Wow.
So the rule ties the confirmation document to the completion of that process, not the initial handshake.
Which honestly makes total sense when you think about the mechanics of a transaction. Like, you get the final receipt when the transaction is actually finalized.
Right.
You don't get the receipt while the cashier is still scanning your items. You get it when your credit card actually clears.
Perfect analogy, yes.
And just to clarify, what if Betty emails it to him or sends it to an app on his phone? Does that change the deadline?
Not at all. An electronic confirmation is still the written transaction record. You've just changed the delivery channel.
Okay.
You haven't changed the content requirements, and you certainly haven't changed that at or before completion deadline.
So digital doesn't mean instantaneous rule.
Nope. The clock is the clock.
Okay, so Betty hits the deadline. Let's talk about what is actually printed on that receipt.
The fun part.
You know, right? You obviously have the basics, you know, the date, the time, the identity, the security, the price, the quantity.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a massive pivot point on this document, a piece of information that dictates an entirely different set of rules, depending on what it says.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about the firm's capacity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Capacity is the engine of the confirmation document. The operations department has to know, did broker Betty act as an agent or did she act as a principal?
Let's build out a real-world analogy for this, because I know this trips people up constantly.
Oh, yeah. It's tricky.
Let's imagine Betty acting as an agent. In this scenario, she is essentially a personal shopper.
Okay, I like that.
Right, so Carl calls her and says, I need 10,000 Iguana sweaters.
Mm-hmm.
But Betty doesn't actually own any sweaters.
Right.
So she goes out into the open market, finds a third party who is selling them, negotiates a price, and buys them on Carl's behalf.
Mm.
She's the shopper.
Yep.
But what if Betty acts as a principal? In that scenario, she's like a retail store. She already has a warehouse full of Iguana sweaters just sitting in Fiona's vault. When Carl calls, she just sells them to him straight out of her own inventory.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. Personal shopper versus retail store.
Yeah.
And the reason the SEC and FINRA care so much about this distinction is because Betty's compensation is completely different in those two scenarios.
Right, because she's either charging a fee or marking up a product.
Exactly. And when compensation changes, the disclosures must change.
So capacity dictates the disclosure path.
Always. Capacity dictates the disclosure path.
So walk me through the mechanics of that. Let's start with the personal shopper. She's acting as an agent. What does that specifically force her to print on Carl's confirmation?
Well, if she is an agent, she is facilitating a trade between Carl and a third party.
Okay.
Therefore, the confirmation must disclose the other party's name, or at least provide notice that the other party's name is available upon written request.
Gotcha.
But more importantly, she has to disclose the customer PED remuneration.
Remuneration? That's just a fancy compliance word for commission,
very
right?
Much.
Like what Carl is paying her to do the shopping.
Exactly. It's the fee for her service.
Okay.
She also has to disclose if she is receiving payment for order flow.
Oh, payment for order flow? That's a hot topic.
Very hot. And it's a crucial mechanical concept for the exam. Sometimes when Betty routes Carl's order to a specific market maker to get it executed, that market maker pays Betty a tiny fraction of a penny per share just for sending the business their way. Right? So if Betty is getting that kickback, that payment for order flow, she has to state that fact on the confirmation and note that the specific details of that compensation are available upon written request.
Okay, so if I'm visualizing the agent confirmation, it basically says, hey, Carl, I bought these for you from this other guy. I charged you a $50 commission for my time. And oh, by the way, these changed through me a couple of bucks for routing the order there.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So it's total transparency on the personal shopper role.
Yeah.
But what if she is the retail store? What if she acts as principal and sells those shares right out of her own inventory?
Well, if she's a principal, there is no third party to name. And there is no commission because she isn't shopping for you. She is just selling you her property.
Right.
So the disclosure focus completely shifts. The confirmation must state whether the firm was a market maker in that security.
Meaning, do they actively hold themselves out as someone who buys and sells Iguana sweater stock all day long to provide liquidity to the market.
Precisely. And here's where the math gets heavily regulated.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. If the trade is what we call a contemporaneous offsetting equity trade, and the firm is not a market maker, Betty has to disclose the difference between Carl's price and her contemporaneous purchase or sale price.
Okay, wait, let me stop you there.
Sure.
Contemporaneous offsetting equity trade. That is a mouthful. Break down that mechanism for me. What does that actually look like on the trading floor?
So it means Betty bought the shares from someone else and then almost immediately turned around and sold them to Carl as a principal.
So like in the same breath, basically.
Practically simultaneous.
Right.
The regulators want Carl to see the markup. If Betty bought the shares at $10 and instantly sold them to Carl from her inventory at $10.50, she must disclose that 50-cent difference.
Oh, I see.
Furthermore, if it's a national market system stock, so like a major listed stock.
Like Apple or something.
Right. She has to disclose the reported trade price, Carl's price, and any difference between them.
So the regulators are making sure the retail store isn't price gouging the customer by hiding the wholesale cost of the goods.
Exactly. They want the markup visible.
This leads me to a major test prep takeaway for everyone listening. If you get a question on the Series 99 about an agency trade, your brain should immediately start scanning the multiple choice options for words like remuneration, commission, or third party.
That's a great tip.
Right. But if the question is about a principal trade, you need to abandon those words entirely and look for market maker status or price difference. Do not let the exam mix and match the agent rules with the principal rules.
That is a phenomenal strategy because capacity determines the disclosure path. Always.
Yeah.
And there are also conditional disclosures you have to watch out for depending on the specific asset.
Like what?
Well, for instance, what if Carl isn't buying equity in Iguana Sweaters, but he buys a debt security, a bond that is callable?
Meaning the issuer can just redeem it before maturity.
Right. They can just call it back.
I assume the receipt has to scream that fact at him, so he isn't surprised when his bond disappears 3 years early.
Exactly. The confirmation has to explicitly warn him that the debt security might be redeemed early and that this early redemption could affect his actual yield.
Makes sense.
And similarly, if he buys an asset-backed security that can be prepaid, like a pool of mortgages where homeowners might suddenly refinance and pay off their loans early.
Right, because rates dropped or whatever.
Exactly. The yield might vary with that prepayment speed. So the confirmation is structurally designed to prevent nasty surprises about the nature of the asset.
Okay, let's step back for a second and look at this logically. We are saying that every single time a transaction completes, a written notification must be generated and sent.
Yes.
What if Careless Carl is actually behaving himself for once? What if he sets up an automatic investment plan where he buys, I don't know, $50 of a boring S&P 500 mutual fund every single Friday?
A rare smart move for Carl.
Very rare. But does Fiona's clearing firm literally have to print and mail him a piece of paper or blast him an email 52 times a year? He would absolutely drown in confirmations.
You're right. And the SEC recognizes that absurdity.
Oh, thank goodness.
There is an operational exception built into the rules for exactly this scenario. It's called periodic reporting.
Periodic reporting.
Yes. Okay. For certain specific types of repetitive activity, the firm can replace immediate trade by trade confirmations with a summarized periodic report.
What qualifies for that exception? Because I assume he can't do that with his wild penny stock trades.
No, penny stocks definitely do not qualify. The exception specifically applies to periodic plans, like Carl's automatic weekly mutual fund purchase, as well as investment company plans and qualifying money market fund transactions.
So if they aren't sending it at or before completion, what is the new deadline clock for these periodic reports?
The firm must send the statement within 5 business days after the period ends.
Okay, 5 days. But how long is the period?
Now, that depends on the asset.
Wow, of course it does.
Right. For periodic plans and mutual funds, the reporting period is quarterly. So 5 business days after the quarter ends.
Okay.
But for covered money market funds, the period is monthly. So 5 business days after the month ends.
5 business days after the period ends.
Yeah.
Got it. But hold on. Here's another classic place where candidates get tripped up.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear it.
Let's think about what is actually printed on that quarterly periodic statement. It replaces the trade confirmations, right? So does it only show trades?
No. And that is a brilliant trap to highlight.
Yeah, I feel like the exam would love to test that.
They absolutely do. A periodic statement can report much more than just the execution of purchases and redemptions. It also includes non-trade activity.
Like what? Give me an example of a non-trade activity that shows up here.
Dividends. Let's say Carl's mutual fund pays out a dividend, and he has elected to automatically reinvest that dividend to buy more fractional shares.
So he didn't click buy, it just happened.
Right. That reinvestment is a non-trade activity that gets credited to his account. It will absolutely show up on the periodic statement.
Okay.
The rule to remember here is that the term non-trade confirmation doesn't mean there is some magical universal delivery rule for all non-trade events. The reporting requirement is always tied to the specific nature of the activity.
That makes sense. What if Carl gets his whole weird iguana-loving club to pool their money together to buy into a mutual fund? Does everyone in the club get a separate piece of paper?
That introduces the concept of a group investment plan.
Okay.
In a group plan, the individual payments from the club members are usually routed through one designated person.
Like a treasurer or something.
Exactly. So in that scenario, at or before completion of a purchase, the investment company sends that designated person a written notice confirming receipt of the group's total payment.
So they don't mail 20 different receipts.
Right. And the phrase to look for on the exam is designated person. That's the trigger that you're dealing with group plan reporting.
Okay, so we've exhaustively covered the receipt. The trade confirmation tells Carl exactly what he bought, for how much, when it completed, and whether Betty acted as his shopper or a retail store.
Yes.
But a receipt doesn't tell you how a product actually works. It doesn't tell you the risks.
Not at all.
For that, we need the user manual for the security itself. In the securities industry, that user manual is the prospectus.
Yes, the prospectus.
And here is where it gets incredibly fascinating, because the prospectus operates on completely different clocks than the confirmation.
This is a crucial structural distinction. A confirmation does not replace a prospectus, and a prospectus does not replace a confirmation. They are two entirely separate documents serving two distinct regulatory purposes.
Right.
The confirmation proves the math of your specific transaction.
Okay.
The prospectus is the comprehensive, legally binding disclosure document about the issuer's business, their financials, and the inherent risks of the security itself.
Let's lay out a direct side-by-side comparison of the delivery clocks for these documents. If you're listening, visualize three separate stopwatches.
Oh, I like this. Three stopwatches.
We already established the first stopwatch, the confirmation clock. That alarm goes off at or before transaction completion.
Right.
But what about the final prospectus? When does that stopwatch ring?
For a sale by an issuer or an underwriter, assuming no specific exemption applies, the final prospectus must be provided to the purchaser no later than 2 business days after the completion of the sale.
Okay, notice the difference there. The confirmation is at or before completion. The final prospectus is no later than 2 business days after completion.
Exactly.
But then we introduce a third stopwatch, the preliminary prospectus. And the exam sources specifically call out rules for new filers here.
Yes. This is a very specific, highly tested scenario.
Yeah.
If you have a registered distribution by an issuer that has not previously been required to file SEC reports.
Meaning they are a brand new, unseasoned issuer doing an IPO, for example.
Exactly. The participating broker-dealer generally has to deliver a preliminary prospectus to the buyer at least 48 hours before sending the confirmation.
See, I want to push back on that for a second to understand the mechanics.
Sure.
Why? Why does a brand new company trigger a requirement to deliver the preliminary user manual a full 48 hours early?
Right.
Why that specific window?
It all comes down to the mechanics of information asymmetry and regulatory intent.
Okay.
Think about a blue chip stock like Apple or Microsoft.
Sure.
They have been filing quarterly financial reports with the SEC for decades.
Right. Everyone knows what they do.
The public market has completely digested their business models, but a new filer, this is a company that has never opened its books to the public before.
Right, like Iguana Sweaters, Inc. going public for the very first time.
Yeah.
Nobody knows if they're actually profitable or if they're just burning cash in a swamp somewhere.
Exactly. So the SEC's logic is this. Investors need adequate time to digest the complex risks of this completely unknown entity before they are locked into the confirmation of the trade.
Oh, wow.
Because if you send the prospectus at the exact same time as the confirmation, the trade is already done.
The ink is dry.
The investor is already on the hook. By forcing the broker to deliver the preliminary prospectus 48 hours before the confirmation is sent, it creates a mandatory cooling off and review period.
That makes total sense.
You cannot blindside an investor with a brand new company stock and hand them the user manual after the fact. They get 48 hours to read about the risks and back out if they realize it's a terrible idea.
Which, when you frame it around the reality of an IPO, you know you need time to realize the company might have a catastrophic flaw in its supply chain before your cash is legally locked up.
Exactly.
So let's recap those three clocks to cement them. First, the preliminary prospectus for a new filer, at least 48 hours before the confirmation.
Yep.
Second, the trade confirmation, at or before completion of the transaction.
Right.
And third, the final prospectus. Up to 2 business days after completion, keep those 3 distinct timelines strictly separated in your mind. Do not let the multiple choice options blend them into a single jumbled timeline.
Precisely. Because the exam will try to swap the deadlines. They'll ask when the final prospectus is due and offer at or before completion as a distractor.
Oh, man.
Knowing the why protects you from the trap.
Let's follow Carl's money further down the timeline. Let's fast forward a few months.
Okay.
Carl hasn't just bought iguana sweaters. He's bought some tech stocks. He's reinvested dividends. He's sold a bond. His portfolio is just a chaotic, swirling mess of individual trade confirmations.
A nightmare.
It's a total nightmare. He can't possibly understand his overall financial health by staring at a stack of 50 individual receipts.
No.
He needs a high-level dashboard. Enter the customer account statement.
Yes. The account statement is the definitive periodic view of the account. It consolidates everything.
Everything.
It shows the securities positions, the money balances, and all the activity that occurred during the period, along with the firm's contact information.
Okay.
It is essentially the what happened and where do we stand right now document.
Let me ask a direct question to the listener. Think about this scenario for a second.
Okay, get ready.
Carl logs into his account, pulls up his monthly customer account statement, and he wants to figure out if his wild portfolio of animal clothing stocks is actually beating the S&P 500 this year.
Good luck, Carl.
Right. Is the customer account statement the document he uses to calculate his alpha?
I'll give you a second. No, absolutely not.
And that is a classic, heavily tested exam trap.
It really is. A statement tells you what happened. It shows cold, hard facts. Mm. You have this much cash. You own this many shares. You bought this specific asset on Tuesday.
Right.
A performance report, on the other hand, tells you how it performed.
This is exactly where candidates get tripped up. The exam will try to blur the lines between a statement and a performance report.
They absolutely will.
If a multiple choice option talks about rates of return, benchmarking, time-weighted metrics, or how the account performed against an index, you're looking at a performance report.
Yes.
The document's purpose controls its regulatory classification. An account statement does not care about your rate of return. It only cares about an accurate snapshot of your inventory and cash.
That's right. Because the required information on an account statement is specifically designed to help the customer review the account for accuracy and report errors promptly.
All right.
In fact, to ensure that happens, there is a specific mandatory advisory that must be printed on every single statement.
What does it say?
It must advise the customer to report any inaccuracy or discrepancy promptly to the brokerage firm.
And it doesn't just say call us right. It specifically tells them to confirm any oral communications in writing.
Yes.
Why the emphasis on a paper trail? Like, if Carl calls Betty and says, hey, my cash balance is missing a zero, why does he also have to sit down and write a letter?
It has to do with the legal mechanics of the Securities Investor Protection Act, or SIPA.
Okay, SIPA.
SIPA exists to protect customers if the brokerage firm goes bankrupt or fails.
Which happens.
It does. And if Carl just calls broker Betty and yells about his missing money, that verbal complaint just vanishes into the ether.
Right. There's no record of it.
Exactly. Hey. If the firm collapses the next day, there's no proof he ever disputed the balance. So the statement literally instructs him, if you see a problem and you call us, you also need to put it in writing so there is a legally binding auditable record of your discrepancy report.
Oh, well.
It protects his rights under SIPA.
Protect the rights, leave a paper trail. Now let's explore the mechanics of how these statements are actually generated, because this brings us back to the dual firm dynamic.
Ah, yes. Betty and Fiona.
This is where firm Fiona enters the story in a big way.
Yeah.
Let's say Carl finds a massive error on his statement, but the statement was actually prepared, printed, and mailed by firm Fiona, because she is the carrying and clearing firm.
Right. She's the one holding the actual assets in the vault.
But Carl's relationship, the person he actually talks to, is broker Betty at the introducing firm.
Mm-hmm.
From a regulatory standpoint, who does Carl call to report the error? Fiona or Betty?
He must be instructed to report it to both of them.
Both of them.
The rule is very explicit. If an introducing firm and a carrying firm both service the account, the statement's advisory must direct the customer to report the problem to both firms.
Wow.
The statement must physically identify both firms and provide customer service contact information for both.
Even if firm Fiona does 99% of the heavy lifting and her computers are the ones that actually made the math error.
Yes. In what we call a fully disclosed carrying arrangement, the back-end agreement between Betty's firm and Fiona's firm generally assigns statement preparation to Fiona's clearing firm.
Right, because she has the big computers.
Exactly. But that internal allocation of duties does not remove the regulatory requirement.
I see.
The SEC doesn't care how Betty and Fiona divide the chores.
That's their problem.
Right. The statement must identify both firms and tell the customer to notify both firms so that neither entity can claim they were unaware of the discrepancy.
Well, that's smart. They can't point fingers at each other.
Exactly. No plausible deniability.
Okay, let's throw a wrench into this smooth clearing operation. Careless Carl strikes again.
Of course he does.
Let's say Carl decides he wants to get into real estate. But instead of buying a normal, publicly traded home builder stock, he buys into a direct participation program, a DPP, that manages a completely undeveloped swamp in Florida.
A swamp.
A literal swamp.
Yeah.
He also buys some shares in an unlisted real estate investment trust, an unlisted REIT that owns a single decaying strip mall on a dirt road.
Oh, Carl. Why?
Because he's Careless Carl. Yeah. Now, these aren't traded on the New York Stock Exchange. There is no ticker symbol with a LIV up to the second price.
No.
How on earth does firm Fiona's computer system show the value of a swamp on a monthly account statement?
It's a fantastic mechanical question because the traditional pricing feeds just don't work here. You can't just ping an exchange for the last trade price.
Right. You can't check Yahoo Finance for the swamp.
No, you cannot. But the rule dictates that a statement containing a DPP or an unlisted REIT must include a per share estimated value.
Okay.
This value has to be developed through a method reasonably designed to produce a reliable value, like a third-party appraisal.
Wait, let me stop you.
Yeah.
Are you telling me Betty or Fiona has to physically send an appraiser out there in a fanboat to value the swamp every month?
And here is the beauty of studying for the Series 99 operations exam.
What?
It doesn't matter.
Whoa.
Mechanics of how the issuer calculates the value of the swamp is not your problem.
Thank God.
Operations questions test the fact that the estimated value must appear on the statement.
Okay.
Your job in operations is to ensure that the estimated value provided by the issuer or an independent valuation expert is actually printed on the customer's document.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
Not my job to appraise the swamp, just my job to print the number.
Exactly.
But here comes a massive glaring pitfall.
Oh.
If I'm Quarl and I see my swamp shares are valued at $10 a share on my statement, I assume I can log in and sell them today for $10 a share.
And that assumption is exactly what the regulators are terrified of.
Yeah, I bet.
An estimated value is not a market price. It is not a guarantee of liquidity.
Right.
And because of that danger, every single statement that provides one of these estimated values for an unlisted REIT or a DPP must include explicit mandatory disclosures.
What do those warnings have to say? Because I'm picturing giant red flashing text.
It basically is. The statement must warn Carl that the security is not listed on a national securities exchange, that it is generally illiquid. And most importantly, that if he actually tries to liquidate his swamp shares, he might receive significantly less than the estimated value shown on the statement.
Wow. It's basically a giant disclaimer saying, hey, Carl, an appraiser thinks this swamp is worth $10 a share,
yeah,
but good luck finding a human being who will actually hand you a $10 bill for it today.
Exactly. The statement has to protect the firm by aggressively managing the customer's expectations about liquidity risk.
It forces reality onto the document.
It really does.
Okay, let's pivot to a slightly darker mechanism in the financial system. We've talked extensively about the rules for generating, formatting, and delivering these documents.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if someone inside the firm decides to play dirty?
The dark side.
Yeah, let's look at the rules surrounding document integrity.
This is critical because the entire financial system relies on trust in the data. A false price on a statement or a confirmation changes the entire narrative the document tells. If the price is manipulated, the customer might see an incorrect transaction cost, an inflated portfolio value, or a totally inaccurate cash balance.
It's just a lie on paper.
Right. It can conceal the actual terms of a purchase or hide a massive valuation error.
So on the exam, Candidates need to understand the structural difference between falsifying a document and withholding a document.
Yes, they do.
Because the regulators treat them as two entirely separate operational offenses. Let's use a visual analogy.
Okay.
Falsifying a document is like taking a history book and rewriting the chapters. You're actively changing the facts to tell a different story.
I like that.
But withholding the document is like taking the completely accurate history book, locking it in a titanium safe, and swallowing the key.
Ooh.
You aren't changing the facts, you just aren't letting anyone read them.
That captures the mechanics perfectly. So let's look at falsifying first. Falsifying a statement or confirmation is strictly prohibited under all circumstances, period. You are providing the customer with information that is untrue or misleading.
Let me play devil's advocate here with a scenario.
Right.
What if Broker Betty messes up a trade? She accidentally buys iguana sweaters at $12 when Carl told her the limit was $10.
Oh, no.
She feels terrible. So she alters the confirmation to show a price of $10, and she pays the $2 difference out of her own pocket.
Wow.
Right? She falsifies the document to make it look better for Carl. Is that a violation? She's basically giving him free money.
It is a massive violation.
Even if she's helping him.
It does not matter what her intent was. The rule is absolute. Falsifying is prohibited regardless of whether the price change favors or disfavors the customer.
Wow.
You cannot lie on a regulated financial document, even if you think you're playing the role of the Robin Hood broker.
Right.
The document must reflect the cold, hard reality of the execution.
So rewriting the history book is always illegal, even if you give the story a happy ending.
Always.
Got it. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Withholding. This is where I want candidates to pay extreme attention.
Yes. Withholding is uniquely dangerous because it disables the customer's alarm system.
How so?
Well, a document can be 100% accurate. It can have zero false prices, perfect math, and brilliant formatting.
Okay.
But if firm Fiona or broker Betty intentionally fails to deliver that required document to Carl, it is still a catastrophic violation.
But why is it treated so severely if the math is right? Like if there are no lies on the page?
Think about the mechanics of a Ponzi scheme or unauthorized trading.
Yeah.
If a broker is doing things in an account they shouldn't be doing, the account statement is the tripwire.
Right, because the customer would see it.
When the customer opens the mail and sees a trade they didn't authorize, they call the regulators.
Oh, I see.
So withholding the document means the customer literally cannot review the information or report a discrepancy. It strips the investor of their ability to monitor their own money.
So on exam day, you must treat falsifying and withholding as separate, distinct forms of prohibited conduct.
Exactly.
A delivered document can be falsified, and a completely accurate document can be improperly withheld. Both are terrible, but they fail the regulatory standard in entirely different mechanical ways.
Precisely. Altering the truth versus hiding the truth.
All right, let's track Carl's dollar to its inevitable final destination.
The end of the road.
We've executed the trade. We've set the confirmations, we've tracked the portfolio on the statements, and we haven't altered or hidden the paperwork. Now the leaves are falling off the trees. It's the end of the year. The tax man cometh.
Tax reporting and withholding. It is the unavoidable conclusion to all financial operations.
Truly.
The underlying purpose of a tax form is to tell both the customer and the IRS what the account did during the year so that everyone is computing gains, losses, and taxable income from the exact same baseline figures.
Right. The firm handles the reporting, the customer handles the filing.
Yep.
But to understand the reporting, we have to clarify some terminology that constantly trips people up. Specifically, the mechanical difference between cost basis and adjusted basis.
Oh yeah, this is a big one.
I always visualize cost basis as the starting line of a race. It's simply what Carl originally paid to acquire the asset.
That's the perfect starting point. The baseline rule is simple. A property's basis is generally its cost.
Okay.
If Carl buys a share for $50, his cost basis is $50. But over time, tax rules can dictate that you cannot simply stay at the starting line.
Right. Things happen.
Exactly. The rules require mandatory adjustments for various capital account items during the time Carl holds the asset.
Give me an example of a mechanism that would force an adjustment to that starting line.
Let's say Carl buys a bond at a premium, meaning he paid more than the face value of the bond.
Okay.
Over the life of that bond, the tax code requires him to amortize or gradually write down that premium.
Oh,
or perhaps he owns a stock that pays out a return of capital. which means the company is basically handing him back a portion of his original investment rather than paying a profit dividend.
Right.
That return of capital mathematically reduces his original cost.
So if cost basis is the starting line, you apply all these mandatory mathematical adjustments, adding this, subtracting that, and once you cross the finish line, that final number is your adjusted basis.
Precisely. Cost basis is the starting number. A basis adjustment is a required increase or reduction. And the adjusted basis is the final figure after all those required adjustments have been calculated.
Okay.
The tax forms that Fiona's firm generates simply organize and report this final adjusted information to the IRS and to Carl.
Now let's talk about the actual movement of tax money. Let's talk about withholding taxes. I want to ask the listener another direct scenario question.
Get ready.
Let's say Careless Carl is taking a mandatory distribution from an account, and the tax regulations state that a 30% tax must be withheld from the payout. But Carl realizes he needs the full cash amount to buy a boat.
A boat, of course.
He calls broker Betty, completely panicked, and screams on the phone, "I absolutely forbid you from withholding taxes on this distribution. I'll pay the IRS myself in April. Just wire me all the cash right now."
Oh, Carl.
Does Betty have the operational flexibility to listen to him and bypass withholding? Think about it for a beat.
Absolutely not, under no circumstances.
Wow.
And this is a foundational concept to grasp about how brokers interface with the IRS. In these scenarios, the broker is effectively deputized as a tax collection agent.
Really?
Yes. The classification depends entirely on whether the facts of the distribution permit a choice.
Break that down. What's the difference between a choice and a mandate?
If the tax code categorizes it as optional withholding, it means the facts legally permit the customer to make an election.
Okay.
In that specific case, the firm must follow the customer's valid instructions. If Carl says don't withhold and it's optional, Betty doesn't withhold.
Right. She follows his lead.
But if the tax code categorizes it as required withholding, the facts mandate the withholding by law. You must mathematically apply the withholding percentage before the cash leaves the firm, regardless of how aggressively the customer prefers otherwise.
So if you are making flashcards, write this down. A customer's instruction never turns required withholding into optional withholding.
Never.
The operational treatment must follow the tax law, not Carl's feelings, and definitely not his cash flow needs for a new boat.
Exactly.
If the IRS says withhold, Betty withholds the money and sends it to the government, even if Carl threatens to close his account. The operations professional's primary duty in this specific scenario is to the regulation, not to the customer's preference.
Right. The firm faces massive penalties if they fail to execute required withholding. They cannot take on that liability just to make Carl happy.
All right, we have tracked Carl's single dollar all the way from the initial handshake on the trade floor through the clearing vaults of Fiona's firm, onto the monthly dashboard, and finally into the hands of the IRS.
It's been quite a journey.
It has. So let's consolidate everything we've learned. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from Function 1. These are the absolute core mechanisms you need to know cold.
Let's do it.
Number 1, the confirmation deadline.
Written notification must be sent at or before completion of the transaction. Remember, it ties to completion, which is settlement. It does not tie to the trade execution date.
Boom. Number 2, capacity dictates disclosure.
If the firm acts as an agent, the personal shopper, the confirmation focuses on remuneration, payment for order flow, and identifying the third party. If the firm acts as a principal, the retail store selling from inventory, the focus shifts to market maker status and contemporaneous price differences.
Perfect. Number 3, the statement versus the performance report.
Account statements show the factual reality of the account, activity, positions, and money balances. They do not calculate alpha. Performance reports show returns and how the account actually performed against benchmarks or indices.
Okay, number 4, the dual firm dynamic for errors.
If there is both a carrying firm and an introducing firm servicing an account, the mandatory advisory on the statement must instruct the customer to report any discrepancies to both firms, regardless of who actually printed the paper.
And finally, number 5, tax withholding authority.
A customer's preference, instruction, or demand can never legally override a required tax withholding mandate from the IRS. The facts dictate the action, not the client.
Incredible. If you understand the why behind those 5 mechanisms, you aren't just memorizing flashcards anymore. You actually understand the plumbing of the system.
Exactly. You are well on your way to crushing those 35 scored items on the exam.
But before we wrap up, I want to step back and look at the bigger picture. We've spent this entire deep dive obsessing over these exact delivery deadlines. The 48-hour preliminary prospectus rule, the 2 business days for the final prospectus, the at or before completion stopwatch for confirmations.
Right. And it's important to realize that all of these rules were built on legacy financial plumbing.
Oh, absolutely.
They were built for a world where trades took days to settle, where physical stock certificates used to be driven across Manhattan in armored cars.
Exactly. So here's a provocative thought for you to chew on as you study. As the broader financial market slowly moves toward instantaneous decentralized blockchain settlements.
Oh, wow.
Right. How will the SEC's definition of at or before completion have to evolve? If the trade execution, the payment transfer, and the final settlement all happen in the exact same millisecond on a distributed ledger, how does a brokerage firm physically or digitally send a written notification before the completion?
That is wild.
The technology of the market is suddenly moving faster than the rigid clocks that govern it. The plumbing is getting a total software update, and it might just break the old stopwatches.
It's going to be a massive operational headache for the regulators, but honestly fascinating to watch how they adapt the core intent of the rules to a zero latency environment.
Absolutely wild to think about. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into Function 1. Keep grinding, trust your preparation, visualize the mechanics, and go crush that Series 99 exam.